Hi, I'm Johanna Rucker, and I'm 75 years old. Today is December 19th, 2021, and my friend and I are in Tallahassee, Florida, and now here she is.
Hi, this is Sandra Kelly. I'm 73 years old. Today is December the 19th, 2021, and we are recording from Tallahassee, Florida. And I am particularly recording with my good friend, Johanna Rucker.
Okay, Sandra, tell us what you're going to share today.
In our conversations, often, we two, me born in the South and you, Johanna, having come to the South as a young person, we grew up in a pretty rough, frightening era, the 50s and 60s. I guess for some people it wasn't, but for me particularly, it was. And in our conversations, we realized we might be able to share this story with people who've never thought about it from our point of view. And so Johanna said, Sandra, why don't we record it for StoryCorps? And here we are.
And I'd just like to say that Sandra grew up in Tallahassee and experienced all the period of segregation and so on. And I didn't move to South Georgia, 60 miles north of here, until I was seven. I just wasn't nearly as directly involved. So Sandra is a storyteller who I love to hear, and she is going to carry the conversation. So go for it, Sandra.
In our conversations, we decided that maybe what I should do is start with what I saw when I opened my eyes the very first time. There's a philosopher whose name I cannot find, but he said that the things that we see the first time our eyes open imprint us for life. And I am convinced that mine were imprinted with large live oak trees and people, black and white. Those three things color almost every way I look at the world. And so not long ago, I was asked to compose a story about the live oak trees here in Tallahassee, since that's one of my first visions. And I wrote it and spoke it spontaneously without really putting it down on paper. It went right into a recording for the Tallahassee Garden Club about their tour. And it was started by my first live oak tree when I was a child. Our house was sat up on the top of a hill. You know, there are seven hills in Tallahassee, as in Rome. And there was a live oak tree, a young, dirty, strong live oak tree sitting out in front in our yard. And that tree and that little girl, Sandra, bonded from the beginning, the first time I ever saw it. And I grew up from about the age 10 on till I left home to get married, move away, speaking with that live oak tree, leaning against it, touching my little new breasts against it, telling it all of my stories, all of my grievances, all of my fears. And in that era, there were plenty. A lot of live oak trees had been burned or cut years ago, so there were a lot of them that were young and still growing. But there was one down the road from us on High Road that was majestic. Dr. Laura Jepson had saved it, and it was called the Lychgate Oak. It was probably 150 years old when she bought the land and built her little cottage down there. It was a magnificent tree. It's still a magnificent tree, almost completely hidden and fiercely protected from any danger. She built this beautiful little house with a lich gate out front so that when you walked through it, you were into one world and out of it into another. And always when I visited the lich gate house when I was a child with my dad, I watched that tree grow, and I felt like a part of me grew into that tree. It's still there in 2021, a big, strong tree, without any other trees really close to it, so that it was able to build its canopy the way a live oak should. Long branches, an arc in the top, a place for trees nearby to admire, for people to come and sit underneath, and for animals to take shelter and refuge. A tree keeping the water in the soil and watering everything around it, doing what a tree should. Over the years, those trees, I came to know so many of them. And yet my town, Tallahassee, while some of us love its trees, some of us find that they're in the way. And sometimes I think that they're that way about people, too. What do you think, Johanna?
I missed that last sentence. What did you say?
I said, sometimes I think people, different people care about the trees, especially in Tallahassee. There's so many of them. Until we get used to them, they're just part of scenery. And so they're easy to cut down. But some of it,
well,
the trees are
well,
part
I'm,
of who we are.
Like you, I have very deep attachments to the live oak trees, even though I moved here much later. The two, well, I won't try to describe where they are, but I would say I have six or eight trees that I feel I have to go to once in a while and just imagine myself inside of the trunk, sitting inside of the trunk, cross-legged, with my root chakra connected with the roots of the tree and my crown chakra connected with the branches. And it saves me from being too anxious or too disoriented. It brings me back to earth in a very loving way.
I think I understand that. And I think there is something to the rootedness when we physically touch the tree, when we listen to them, and there is a lot going on in a tree. And when we sit with the earth and feel the liveness, the vibrancy of the tree and the earth coming into us, I mean, it's a lot harder to cut something down when you've experienced that kind of intimacy with it.
Yes.
So should we talk about my early memories about Black people?
Well, I'm interested, sure. Let's go with it.
Well, what are you interested in, though, that I needed to say more about?
Well, I find your experience of being in high school and having grown up in a segregated mindset in your family, and then having a friend in high school who is Black, that's so interesting.
Oh, yeah, it was. Especially because of the way I grew up. Because my family was multi-generational from here. They were here early on in the 1800s when people still thought they owned other people. And they owned specifically Black people. And from my earliest memory, I couldn't understand it. Even when we got to school and we learned a little tiny bit about slavery, I didn't understand it. But from the things I saw, I began to understand oppression. And even then, because I was not personally oppressed, I could not really understand how it felt. I never could have understood that. But I saw the hurt in people's eyes. I remember one time I was in a line with a man at a store, and he was a black man. And I had nobody else to ask the question of, but he would not lift his head, and he would not look at me. And a long time ago, black people were not allowed to look at us in the eye. And I finally walked over to him, and I said, "Would you look at me, please?" And he looked at me, and his eyes were so beautiful. They were this stunning gray. And I saw the hurt, and for just a minute, I think I felt just a little bit of it. It came through. And we talked, and it was an ordinary conversation, and I apologized for interrupting him. But I remember when Marlon first came to Florida High, I went to the university school at FSU for 12 years. And in high school, there was the integration movement, which was so powerful. And I felt like I was caught up in it by that time because I knew a whole lot more. But, of course, our schools, from the very beginning, were segregated, even at FSU. Even though at FSU we had people from India, from Arabia, from China, we still didn't have any black people. And he came, and he was assigned to my desk. I was thrilled, actually, to be chosen to be his teammate. My little nosy self, because I was curious. But you know, from the very beginning, he looked me in the eye. I think maybe they chose those kids, or those kids volunteered. I have no idea how they chose them. But he became a hero of mine because it was not easy for him. People were not always kind, even at Florida High, where people from all over the world at that time. But never once did I ever see him grumble, did once I ever see him complain. He did what he needed to do. He made superior grades. He graduated. He went on to be a professional man. I lost track of him. But he had my admiration then, and I turned from being a self-important little thing who thought she had been chosen to being very honored that I had the opportunity to sit by that young man.
Wow.
Yes, that's a strong memory, very strong memory.
And I would love to hear you talk about the time that you tried to sit in the back of the bus. And before you say that, I would just like to say that I have another friend who had a black nanny, I guess we would call it now, and she used to ride around in the back of the bus with the nanny, but she was only allowed to sit there in the back of the bus because she was with the nanny. So what happened to you when you wanted to sit in the back of the bus?
I used to go downtown. Both my parents worked downtown. My dad was a watchmaker and a gemologist at a jewelry store, and my mom was a dental hygienist. And so often on Wednesdays, I would go down on the city bus. And I'd spend the afternoon down there, and I'd go to the movies, and I'd see everything I could see. Only that time, I decided that because the bus sit-ins were going on around the country, and I was very interested in that, and I never really thought about the fact that only black people sat in the back, unless the nannies had their little charges. And so I thought, well, I will show my agreement with them, and I'll just sit back there. I'm a big girl now. I don't need a nanny, but I'll sit back there. But those ladies would not let me sit back there. I didn't know if they were trying to protect me, maybe, maybe they were trying to keep me from getting in trouble, probably. And also,
so how did they keep you from sitting back there?
Well, it wasn't my battle, and they didn't want me back there. So what they did was they shuttled closer together, and they all looked up at me, and it was like their heads shaking. You can almost see it, their heads shaking. No, you are not going to sit back here. Well, I was terribly embarrassed because I was going to be a hero. You know, I was going to show my solidarity with their cause. And so they made me, with their eyes, walk up to the front of the bus and find myself a place to sit. Everybody looking at me like, you stupid little girl, you should have known better.
Oh, well, you should have known better.
I should have known better, yeah. Don't get above yourself. You know where you belong.
Or below yourself.
That's right. That's right. But I would have been trying to be a hero. I was trying to make a statement. And they didn't want
you were,
me.
You were
my
what?
Statement.
You were in your mid-teens at that point? Or?
Yeah, probably about 14.
So that would have been around what year, just for history's sake?
Well, I graduated from high school in 1966, so I would have assume it was in the early 60s, somewhere in the
early 60s. Well, another story that my friend who did sit with her nanny in the back of the bus, another story she had was that her mother, who was very much a Tallahassee person, used to frequent McCrory's, which was a combination lunch counter and drugstore, is that right?
No, it was a Five and Dime.
Oh, Five and Dime, but they did have one. They had a lunch counter in there. So my friend's mother took her cousin there one time, who was visiting from out of town, and her cousin was a full-blooded Cherokee woman. And McCrory's refused to serve the cousin because she was dark-skinned. And my friend's mother was infuriated and announced that if they didn't serve her, the Cherokee woman, she was never coming back. And she didn't ever come back to McCrory's.
Mm.
So you have a McCrory's story too, right?
Yeah, I used to go there after I'd get downtown. I'd go there and get myself something to eat at the lunch counter.
What would you get? What did you?
Oh, lemon meringue pie.
Oh.
They made it there, and it was perfection. My mother couldn't even make it that good. It was just beautiful. And they always had, you know, beautiful crockery plates and real flatware. No plastic in those days, thank God. And counter was polished, and there was a mirror that stretched all the way across it from one end of the store to the other, it seemed to me, in those days. And that day, though, when I got there, I noticed there were a lot of African-American people approaching McCrory's. And I thought, whoo, I need to find out what's going on over there. I really was footloose and fancy free. I could go anywhere. And so I kind of slid in with them when they went into the store, having no clue what they were about to do. And to my surprise, they filed right over there to the lunch counter, and all the white people who had been sitting there got up and left. And all of those beautifully dressed in their Sunday best people, I think most of them could have been from Florida A&M University. They filed in, and they filled every seat, and they sat there expecting to be served. And it was quite clear to me that they had no intention of getting up until they were served. I made my way back to the Tangi counter. They had these wonderful wooden counters, and all the displays were laid out right there. And I looked around the corner, and I could just see my own self in that long mirror. And I watched all those people. I knew my father would probably kill me if he knew I was there. And sure enough, the waitresses were just in shock. They had no clue what to do. They were accustomed to being told what to do and what to do. Had never come up, apparently, about serving a black person. And they stood there frozen, their mouths open. And I could see that whole thing reflected back and forth in that long mirror. And finally, somebody gave them the words. And they started serving those people. And they ate
really?
At that lunch for the very first time. And I was there, and I saw it.
Wow.
Even now, it does something in my heart. It's like a unique kind of joy, probably, because I truly never did understand why they couldn't. Why?
Right.
The heck? Why? I don't care what anybody
So you were there
me.
At a...
No.
You were there at a truly historic instant.
I truly was, just this little old scrap of a child who had no business being there, but was very lucky she was, because I think it did something to me. It made me go ahead and conclude for my own self that everybody is equal and everybody is deserving of rights. They're ours by birth, and even the Constitution says so. But why shouldn't we just do what we're supposed to do? But I didn't tell my dad. I never told my father. Because
how do you imagine he would have responded if somebody else maybe had said, oh, I saw Sandra's reflection in the mirror at McCrory's during that sit-in, what would he have done?
Well, he was a hot-tempered redhead.
Uh-oh.
And he probably would have taken me when I got home straight to the bathroom and given me a spanking no matter how big I was.
Oh, okay.
Or more. Yeah, I mean, corporal punishment was a little different for children then in those days. We got spankings. But that would have been more than spankings.
Wow.
Yeah, that would have been a lot more, and I knew it. Sometimes
wow.
You have to learn wisdom for self-protection, and that was one of them.
Yeah. So later as an adult, how did you manage the story of growing up in that era for yourself? And how did you shift your own understanding and behavior?
I think growing up, I found my own ways to make peace with my own behavior. I am not a marcher. I am not a big protester. But in everything that I did, my own personal self, I tried to be honest and honorable and to treat people the way I wanted to be treated. And I tell you, it's not as easy to do in a society that was as angry as it was at that time.
Right.
The fury was out of control. And I think at that time, too, the greasy press, I think of it as the kind of marketing they learned to do at that period of time was anger and fury. We have a lot of it now. And this period of time we are in now reminds me of it. And it is a fearful time to me because I don't want us to go back there.
No.
No matter what I've seen, what I have heard, nothing I've seen except for January the 6th, which was almost just like it. I just saw it, and it made me so ill that we could see a country like that with all of our high pretense of what we are and are not, how we could kill and destroy and disrespect.
Well, going back to the early days, you know, having been a teenager in a totally segregated town, Moultrie, Georgia, which is just 60 miles north of here, I never saw black people at all because they were on the other side of the tracks. And the only time I would see them is if somebody came to do chores for my mother. And so much later, when I was in my 20s, I went back to Moultrie to see if I could find one black person who could tell me the story of their experience in Moultrie. And the man that I spoke to had been a bellhop at the Colquitt Hotel, and his name was Wesley Ball. And at the time I spoke to him, he was the mayor pro tem of Moultrie. But he had been, you know, just seen as, he wasn't a dark-skinned black, so I think somehow that was more acceptable. And a lot of the bellhops in these small-town hotels came from that kind of situation. But yet now would have been 20 years, probably the late 70s. He could be at least the mayor pro tem of Moultrie. So that was pretty remarkable. So I'm wondering about your situation. Other than seeing somebody working in a store, did you ever see black people other than your house seatmate at school?
More than what you experienced, apparently. There are a lot of black people here, and we also have the FAMU, the university. And I think perhaps growing up, I literally grew up with the changes as they occurred. I do remember some of the very first black people I knew, though, because we were very strictly, you're right, very segregated. But at that time, we lived close to Florida State and close to the stadium area. And the first black people that I recall as a child, one was the Iceman. Now, I'm 73 years old, so you know that I've been around a while. And at that
the
time,
Iceman.
Yeah, exactly. And at that time, as a teeny tiny tot, we didn't have electricity for our refrigerator, I suppose. We have an icebox. And this wonderful man would come with his mule and wagon with these giant blocks of ice. There was an ice factory over by the railroad track close to All Saints neighborhood. And he would come walking down the road, and we'd hear that mule's harness jangling, and we'd all go crazy and get up behind the ice wagon to try to catch that ice as it dripped off the water, as it dripped off as he came. And I'd run around and I'd tell Mom, "The Iceman's here, the Iceman's here." And she would run to the back of the house, and he would take these giant tongs, and he was probably the most muscular human being I ever saw up close in my lifetime. And he would clamp those tongs around that giant thing and pull it out of that sawdust and hay and walk around to the back of our house and up the back door steps. And my mom would have opened the screen door and propped it and pulled open the inside door, and she stood behind it with her head down, and I knew she was afraid. I was. I knew it. And that big man would step into our house with his head down too, never catching her eye. And he would put that big block of ice in that ice box, and she would hand him his money from her apron. Down he would go, still with those eyes downcast. And he and the mule would go to the next place that he was supposed to leave ice.
Wow.
What a strange picture that is, Johanna. It seems possible, does it? My mother was afraid. She was afraid. And that man was afraid. He knew if he made one step wrong, he could be a dead man.
He could be in jail.
No, probably dead. Because that was a white woman. Yeah.
Bringing this story back around to the live oaks. There is an oak in Tallahassee that some people say is associated with hangings.
Yeah.
What do you know about that?
I don't know very much about it. I recall it was up there near the fruit market. The fruit market used to be off Gaines Street, where now the Cascade is, and there were state buildings up there for a long time. But every now and then something would happen and you'd hear that, you know, a long time ago somebody had been hung from that oak tree. Well, to me, the tree itself had nothing to do with the hanging. But to the people in the community, it had become a significant tree. And I can imagine those black farmers who also brought their produce up to the fruit market. They're the ones who remember the hangings on that tree. You don't hear very many white people who will talk about it. And it's like when I first heard that that was a hanging tree, I couldn't believe it. You know, I had this romantic affair with that beautiful tree, and my granddaddy never mentioned it. Well, it must not be. Do you know what? The people who experienced it have the memories. And they say it was, so it was.
Well, the tree that I associate with that story, perhaps wrongly, is covered with warts.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre and ugly and scary looking. And I don't know if that's the tree, or if it is the tree, was there something about all that terrible, hateful energy that warped the tree itself?
I don't know, because that tree did not look that way then. And the road was also redirected. So used to, the road wasn't sitting right on top of that tree.
Right.
And it had a huge canopy. And I don't understand why that tree has been treated the way it has. It's black. It's not gray like a live oak should be. And it does look horrendous. I mean, they cut all of the canopy away. And I don't understand why they didn't just go ahead and cut the tree down. But I think it may be that there's that history of it that determines it should be there as a reminder.
Uh-huh.
And I agree.
So tell me about when you would be with your mother or father when they would go over to that side of town where the laundry was dropped off.
Yeah, Smoky Hollow, which was just beyond there. That's
just
close,
beyond there, close, right?
Close to the Myers Park area, which is close to the country club, which is close. And there are all kinds of stories involved in all of that. But Smoky Hollow at that time was, I have mixed emotions about it. The lady who did, Miss Annie, the lady who did my dad's shirts for many years until Permanent Press came out and put her out of business, she lived in Smoky Hollow with her family. And that's how she, her husband, I forget what he did, but she put our children through college ironing shirts. Smoky Hollow is a really phenomenal place. It's now, I don't know, it's strange. I wish they hadn't torn it all down. I wish that we kept it, but in the 60s, they decided to do what is called urban renewal, which I personally felt was a bunch of rubbish. What they wanted to do was to eliminate the vision of anything black and black people or anything belonging to them. Well, the thing is, the only way you can get rid of it all is because they built the whole dang town. All these artistic homes that are still here, they built. But their own homes were these beautiful little bungalows that I came to love. And Smoky Hollow, when the sun would start going down and the fog would come in, it was a dip in the road. And the fog would gather there. So it looked mysterious, and all the stories people would tell. So we'd get home on our Sunday afternoon jaunts. We'd go to the airport to watch the jet come in. We'd go to the fruit market. And then we'd go to Miss Annie's to leave the shorts and pick up the noodles. And Daddy would
And did you find that scary?
Mysterious.
Did you find it scary to go there?
Mysterious. Not
oh,
scary.
Mysterious. But not scary.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not me.
Okay.
But it was not a place where white people were welcome. We had our place. We were coming to do service with her, and then we were to leave. And we never
sort
spoke
of like
to anybody.
The back of the, sort of like the back of the bus.
Yeah, you know. And it was kind of like a reversal type thing. You know, they had their place, and they didn't want us there. And I can't
a territorial, yeah, territorial thing.
Maybe a little bit, but she was such a sweet lady. I just could tell that she was. And Daddy was very fond of her, but if she had stepped outside of her boundaries, he would have put her back in really fast.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
Not only for her own sake, but because it would have been inappropriate. I watched my father change now. I really have to say, because when we had, as a very small child, we had maids, and they were always black, and they were always kind, and I thought every black woman was a Christian. I thought every black person was a Christian. Because they had turned to the church, and the church was where they got their, kept their sanity, I guess.
Well,
and it became,
well,
yeah.
Sandra, we're, we got just a couple minutes left, so.
Oh, no.
What else would you like to say before we close?
I want to tell you about the young man that washed the windows at Putnam Jewelers where my father worked. He was a phenomenal young man. I'll call him Joseph. And he and I became very good friends over the years that he worked there. But one Wednesday, he had to take a special watch out to my father, and it was Dad's day off that day. And when he came up the driveway, I ran out and I hugged him because I was so glad to see him. And he hugged me right back. And my dad saw it, and I thought he was going to kill Joseph. I really did. And then afterwards, I got the licking of my life. And
wow.
Joseph continued working at that store. Daddy became his mentor. They became respectful of one another. Joseph never spoke to me or laid eyes on me. He never locked eyes with me another time in my whole life. And I just heard recently that he became a professional man and has lived a good life, and I wish I could talk to him. That's not his name, by the way. But I saw my father change. He never used the N-word anymore. He became respectful. And he even did jobs for Black people, and they paid him. They came to our home and sat in our living room. And I want you
How
to know
beautiful.
That people can change. People can change.
People can change.
And that's my
and
story.
That gives us hope. So thank you so much for all that you do as a storyteller to bring these things to light. And to and I just want to observe that while you said that you never experienced prejudice, in a way, being victimized by prejudice the way you were by your dad and perhaps others, you might not have thought of it the same way, but it was definitely wounding.
It was wounding, it was deep, and it was permanent. I remember all of it, and I remember the fear. I remember the expressions on their faces, and I remember thinking and knowing this is wrong.
This is wrong. Well, slavery wasn't that long ago, and may we quickly shift our hearts to be all-inclusive.
That's the prayer, because for some of us, it obviously worked. My admiration for those people knows no bounds. I cannot believe they survived what they did, and that they are accomplishing what they are now, and that we are all together anyway.
Yeah.
We have to keep working at it. We have to keep working. We can't stop.
Black lives matter. All lives matter.
Well, you know, in this case, I think when they say Black Lives Matter, I think we need to remember that that is their battle cry. Black lives do matter. And they are unique to themselves, but they are all part of all of us. And it's time we learned not to be so separate.
Well, thank you so much. Have we completed our story today?
I think we can keep talking until Sarah stops us.
Okay.
Were you timing it yourself? Oh, I know. I remember a story. If she doesn't interrupt, I'd like to. Remember when I said that we had maids when I was little? We had a wonderful woman. Her name was Florida, and that was her name. And she took care of me. She took care of me. She ironed my clothes. She washed my clothes. She did everything for me. And I loved that woman. And if I ever see her again, or if she is still alive, or for some reason she hears that, I still love her. And I think what an important impression she made on me as a tiny little girl, because she was so kind to me and so caring. Under very difficult circumstances. I'm sure my mom didn't know what to do with how to be a boss lady. You know, I hope my mother treated her kindly and well. I would like to think that she did. But I remember as a child when they would polish silver. We did have silver at our house. And it had to be polished. It seemed like in those days before air conditioning, everything just tarnished off. It would just get really dark. And they'd lay it all out on the table and polish and polish and polish. And that was one of the jobs that Florida did.
Mm.
It's funny now. I have silver. You know where it is? It's in a box out out somewhere in storage. Who uses it? Who has need for it now? I don't know.
We got our silver service from Green Stamps. That was one of my jobs, was to lick green stamps. Well, I used a sponge, but took a lot of green stamps.
Yeah, of course it did. F and H green stamps.
Yes.